Today on Annenberg Radio News.
I'm not getting ready to look pretty for like a hot date that I have. I'm getting ready to like pretty much be a showpiece.
We take a look at the complicated life of an LA stripper. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Tuesday, April 15th, 2014. I'm Ani Ukar. It's tax day. Have you filed your taxes? Sean Birch found a lot of people who waited until the last minute to file theirs. He brings us this report.
Patriots across South LA are cramming into the post office to pay their taxes on time. The line at USC's mailroom extended out the door. I asked a few people waiting in line why they waited until the last minute to fulfill their civic duty.
TurboTax lets you do your federal for free, so I got that out of the way, and then I procrastinated on a state. So
I actually prepared them ahead of time, but I just waited until the last minute to come to the post office. I did have multiple reminders on my phone set up.
This is my first time mailing my tax return, and I'm an international student, which means in my own country I don't have to do this. So I have to figure out everything that I need to do.
Down the street at H&R Block on the corner of Figueroa and Adams, manager Sharif Sao talked about the busy tax season.
We have two peak. The people who are getting a refund, we call people who are low income, counting on what we call earned income credit, come heavily around February. And the people who have a balance due and they know that they have to pay IRS, they basically come the last minute, like around April 12 or 15.
But should you be sprinting over to the closest mailbox to make sure you get it in before the deadline? Probably not. For the 75% of Americans who expect a refund, you can get an extension up until October 15th. So go ahead and relax if you haven't turned in your taxes by now. Unless you owe the IRS money. Then you should sprint over to the post office on Jefferson. It's open until 5:30. Sean Birch, Annenberg Radio News.
'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah.
Mayor Garcetti today signed an overhaul of LA County's trash hauling system into law. The system will divide the city into 11 districts, each served by one trash company, which will be required to provide bins for recycling and organic waste. Supporters of the new system say the change will help the environment by cutting down on truck traffic and increasing recycling. Google Glass went on sale this morning, but only for one day. Some consumers are quickly jumping online to get their hands on the wearable computer, but others are raising privacy concerns. Should you buy Google Glass? Andrea Martinez just might help you decide.
If you've been in the market for some cool new specs, today is the only day to get your hands on Google Glass, the wearable device that, up until today, has only been available to developers, or explorers, as Google calls them. A glass screen covering your left eye allows you to take pictures, record video, ask for directions, and share content with friends. But first, you'll have to fork over $1,500. And some people have already bought them. Consumer Watchdog calls those people glass holes. They held a press conference this morning detailing their issues with the glasses. John Simpson said privacy is most pressing.
Basically, under its terms of service, any videos, photos that you load up to its services, which is what you do when you use Glass, Google has the ability to do virtually whatever they want with it.
Google can build a personal profile of its users using recent searches, photos, and facial recognition. Jamie Court says all this can become public record.
And remember, any picture you take is frozen in time. It can be used with facial recognition software later. It can be used in close-up later. So literally everything we do in public, if this becomes a device that's worn on a widespread basis, will suddenly become a public record for a lot of scrutiny in ways that I don't think we could imagine it.
Scrutiny or not, there are still the handful of people who think Google Glass is actually the future.
I see it changing the way we use computers because we won't need screens anymore. We won't need TVs anymore. We'll be able to watch 3D via glasses like this.
That is technology entrepreneur Vivek Wadhwa, who thinks Google's version of Glass is only the lesser version of what's really to come.
Just like contact lenses and glasses enhanced our vision, hearing aids enhance our hearing, this is going to enhance our knowledge.
But Wadhwa also has some concerns about the future of this technology.
Imagine having sunglasses, or imagine having regular eyeglasses that have the same features and functions as Google Glass, but you don't know that anyone's wearing them. Imagine having buttons on your shirt which have cameras which can film in higher definition. See, right now the debates are because it's so visible and people think that they're being spied on. And there are going to be a lot of nasty debates about what future we've gotten into.
David Carr, computer science student at the University of Southern California, is taking a class on Google Glass next semester. And he says Glass improves his day-to-day life.
Lots of photos that I've captured I wouldn't have otherwise because I'd be filming from my phone. It's really nice to be able to respond to notifications just while I'm riding my bike and just get my messages brought to me. It's always fun to be able to Google something on the spot.
When getting directions, all Carr has to do is talk to Glass.
I would say, okay, Glass, get directions to the Lion Center. And I'll immediately get a map that pops up with directions, and when I need to make a turn, Glass will wake up and alert me.
Despite all the debate, Wadhwa says Glass still has glitches, like the chunkiness of the screen, which he says is weird and can cause distraction. Andrea Martinez, Annenberg, Radio News.
The LA County Sheriff's Department is planning to implement more technology within the next year in county jails. By doing this, the department hopes to continue to decrease violence within jails. Camille Riquesa spoke to the Sheriff's Department and concerned citizens about this issue.
The LA Sheriff's Department is trying to decrease violence in jails. The Sheriff's Department informed the Board of Supervisors today on their progress on this issue. They also proposed new ways to prevent situations where violent behavior could occur.
I think the Sheriff's Department's making enormous strides in implementing these reform efforts.
Terry McDonald is the Assistant Sheriff. She says the number of violent interactions between police officers and inmates has decreased since last year. There were 95 reported incidents in 2013 and only 14 reported for this year, according to the Sheriff's Department. The department is focused on adding new technology in county jails to help them monitor violent situations. One thing the department is planning to start using is body scanners to search for weapons and drugs. These scanners would give inmates another option instead of a strip-down search.
Think about when you have to stand in line here to process in, or at the airport. It just causes anxiety. This is designed to reduce anxiety and reduce contraband coming in the jail.
McDonald says scanners have been implemented in other counties and have worked well in reducing tension between officers and inmates. Although it has worked elsewhere, there are some people who are skeptical about the way it will be used. Eric Previn is running for the 3rd District Supervisor. He says if the city introduces the scanners in jails, they should be used consistently.
We need to be doing it to everybody, because if we're just doing it to sort of 10% of the population that goes into that building, well then what about the possibility of them migrating in the other 90%? So it is an absurd kind of an exercise unless we clarify how are we going to make sure that we're really limiting it.
The LA Sheriff's Department will implement 2 body scanners for a trial period on April 21st. Camille Riquestas, Annenberg Radio News.
Human rights activists are gathering tonight in Los Angeles to address human rights violations in the Philippines. As Kylie Morgan reports, they are offering support to the indigenous people displaced by the violence.
The Manobo people are one of the few remaining indigenous communities in the Philippines. Human rights activists say over 1,000 Manobos in Mindanao have been forced to flee their homes in the wake of an aggressive military presence. Cusella Hilo from the International League of People Struggle in the U.S. says she has visited the military-occupied villages over the last 2 years. The military is searching for rebels opposed to the government, but civilians say they are the ones being harassed.
Dropping bombs in civilian communities is a human rights violation.
Hilo says attacks against the Manobo people are just a part of what is happening in the Philippines.
In that immediate area, yes, it is primarily the Manobo people. But you can see forced evacuations and militarization all across the Philippines. Sadly, the crisis in Davao del Norte is just a microcosm of what is happening in the Philippines today.
Human rights activists say tribal leaders tell them the military is keeping people from gathering food on their farms, and many people are starving.
There's more than 500 children who are evacuees right now, and they need a lot of attention.
Hilo says a network of Southern California groups are helping indigenous people by building schools and helping donate a corn mill. Tonight, the forum will feature indigenous leaders from the Philippines and live testimonies from the Manobo people. Kylie Morgan, Annenberg Radio News.
One of the most important Jewish holidays began last night. And as Christina Savan reports, some are finding unusual ways to celebrate the Seder.
Today marks the first full day of Passover, and according to Brie Laskota, the managing director of USC's Center of Religion and Civic Culture, many modern-day Jews are reinterpreting the way that they're celebrating the holiday.
What Jews have come to do as a result is to also reinterpret the Seder and the observance of Passover to give it contemporary meaning. So an interfaith Seder between Muslims and Jews, or between Jews and Latinos, or Seders that focus on a particular issue.
In addition to remembering the Jewish exodus from Egypt, Laskota says that some Seders also include the remembrance of worldwide modern-day genocides. And some pray for the Palestinian homeland. And this year, some Seders are being held in some non-traditional places.
I'm the co-owner of Canner's Fairfax. We're open 24 hours a day, so if somebody wants to come in here and have their own Seder at 2 in the morning, they're perfectly welcome to do it. Most families, though, meet together between 5 and 8 o'clock on both first and second nights of Passover.
Christina Savan, Annenberg Radio News.
Get excited, Angelinos. The weather today is going to be classic SoCal. Tonight's lows will be in the mid-50s, with tomorrow and Thursday staying breezy in the 70s. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we talk with Catherine Cloutier, a Boston Globe reporter, about the city of Boston's recovery 1 year after the marathon bombings. Now we continue our series looking at the people who make Los Angeles run. The night shift workers, the minimum wage employees, and the undocumented laborers. For the seventh story in this series, we take a trip downtown where reporter Eamon Oyibik introduces us to Venus. Venus is making a living as a stripper, and she has mixed feelings about her job.
Her day normally starts at 10:30 a.m. at Sam's Hofbräu's Gentleman Club, inside a small concrete dressing room. She puts on her makeup, sucks in her cheeks, and sweeps a light pink blush on the apples of her cheekbones. She styles her long brown hair with a pink flat iron. She is mentally preparing herself for a long day of dancing.
I'm not getting ready to look pretty for like a hot date that I have, or to go to like dinner or movies with friends. I'm getting ready to like pretty much be a showpiece in an auction.
Venus, who asked to be called by her dancer name for this story, began working at downtown LA's Sam's Hofbräu Club 8 years ago. She is someone who has a growing love for culinary arts. This is not who she sees herself as, but she figured she could fake it. She had bills, and pole dancing was the quickest way to make cash.
I'm not the cutest girl in the bunch, but I think with a few shots, I can be pretty charming and make 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks from one guy and 10 from another and, you know, work my way through the day.
Before hitting the club floor, she looks at herself in the mirror. She raises her eyebrows, turns her head to the side, and sucks in her stomach. She glides on her 7-inch platform heels, locks her locker, and fixes a smile on her face and struts out onto the club floor. For a second, she scales the room for wide-eyed, eager men looking to get a lap dance.
Oh, now he's smiling.
Unlike other service-based workers, Venus doesn't make any kind of consistent salary. All of her income is tip-based, so she has to become a saleswoman And in pole dancing, it is all about body language if you want to seal the deal with tips. And for Venus, tips can be unpredictable.
Some days I make less than a person who has a 8 to 10 hour job making minimum wage, you know? It's always a gamble. I don't have fake tits and I don't have fake ass and I don't have any surgery on my face and I'm a little chunky. So I have to work harder because guys aren't drawn to me like they are drawn to women with all that.
And there are expenses. Every day she dances, Venus has to pay a $20 house fee.
So it's like our real estate fee, basically, so we can, like, because we're independent contractors. And then we tip out 10% of what we make to the DJ.
The fee is waived for dancers that usually come in before 11 because the day shift isn't as full as the night shifts. This is the main reason why Venus works during the day.
It usually costs more to work at night because you're tipping managers and people who pass money out. I really don't like to work at night because, for one, it's not worth the drama, and, like, two, I don't like tipping out people money that don't deserve it.
For Venus, the strip club is a stage, a place for her to become a new character. Someone that has no connection to her life outside of the club. And here she is, Venus, this character who fulfills erotic fantasies. She says it's acting at its best. Amen, Oyeboke, Annenberg, Radio News.
All my troubles in the rearview mirror, I know, I know. All my troubles in the rearview mirror, I know.
Los Angeles is a vast city where neighborhood lines can be blurred, and sometimes residents don't know what to call the place where they live. The neighborhood of South Central Los Angeles became infamous all over the world, associated with poverty, gangs, and drugs. But can a new name change that reputation? That's what the Intersection South LA website is trying to explore. Daniel Carr Crawford spoke with Intersection's editor, Dana Solomon.
What's this project that we're going to be talking about today?
Well, I'm here to talk about South LA versus South Central. What's in a name? And we at Intersections are asking various people around LA which name they prefer and why, South LA or South Central. And we think it could be a way to help us understand what's going on in South LA right now, what issues people care about.
South Central LA originally referred to the area south of downtown along Central Avenue. Those were the days when racial covenants restricted where African Americans could buy homes. When the covenants were lifted in the 1940s, black homeowners started moving westward, but the name South Central stuck as they moved into other areas.
This neighborhood, it started getting a reputation for a lot of poverty and crime and shootings and urban blight. And that all kind of ignited with the riots in 1992. So the city decided it needed to step in and do something. But one of the things was to make an official name change. So in 2003, they decided to change the name from South Central to South LA. And that name was very quickly picked up by mainstream media.
People in the area want to stay with the name South Central LA. But do they care about the perception that has outside of the community?
I think they do care about the name that's used by the rest of the world and what that shows about them, because I think they're really proud of coming from a region that's been really complicated and has had different troubles over the years, and that they've been able to come out of that and survive and lead good lives, and I think it's kind of a point of pride.
I spoke to a number of students, and many of them said that they believe the stigma is still going to stay no matter what the name is changed.
I would say South LA does have a more positive connotation when compared to, let's say, West LA, which is associated with affluence. South LA can also have some sort of resonance with East LA, which I know some people consider a blighted area that also has a lot of crime.
I think although the name does have a specific connotation to it, I think just being in this area in general might give a different view of it. And I think that's something you can't really change until you actually start working within the city.
Yeah, that's also something I've heard as well, that you can change a name, but it's still very superficial. And what's most important is, if you want to change a neighborhood or make it into a more positive place, is to do kind of changes that will have a deeper impact. All sorts of things that could really make a difference, more than something like changing a name that is more superficial.
With all that said, what do you hope to get across to people like me, USC students, and people in the South LA community that might be reading this as well?
Just to kind of check in with South LA and say, hey, you know, you're here, we're here. The name got changed officially in 2003, so it seems like a good time now to ask about the names South Central versus South LA, just as a way to get people talking about what's going on in their neighborhoods.
1 year ago today, the nation watched in horror as the Boston Marathon bombings unfolded. The two explosions that went off near the finish line killed three people and injured more than 260 others. Earlier, I spoke with Catherine Cloutier of the Boston Globe, who covered the bombings that day. I asked Cloutier to take me back to where she was at 2:49 p.m., the exact minute the bombs went off.
I was actually in a news budget meeting where we plan our coverage, and we were actually talking about the marathon because most of the elite runners had already crossed the finish line, and we were trying to figure out what was next. And I happened to be checking Twitter on my phone, and I saw a photo of an explosion at the finish line. And I handed it to my news editor, Angela Nelson, and she raced it into the newsroom, and from then on, it was just a whirlwind of a week.
What did you guys do first?
So the first thing we did was we use a program called Scribble Live. It's a live blogging software, and we set about live blogging what was being seen on Boylston Street. And that was both our reporters that were there, but also citizens who were posting photos on Twitter. And at first, we called it explosions at the Boston Marathon finish line because we didn't know what had happened right away. So we live blogged for several hours. Actually, the website went down for a portion of that afternoon, and we redirected to that live blog. It was our mainstay of coverage for most of that Monday.
I know you guys were just recently awarded the Pulitzer for your coverage of those days' events. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
Do you mind talking to me about what it is your team did that set you guys apart, you know, from everyone else who was covering that day?
We very much relied on our live blog to bring our audience updates to the minute as they were happening. We were working through the nights for most of that week, and in addition to the narrative journalism that the Globe is famous for, we were producing live coverage that I think really contributed to the Pulitzer Prize win.
What was Boston like a year ago, and what is it like today?
So after the bombs exploded, I think the city didn't really know how to process it, and so for several days, people kind of dealt with the grief that is what had happened. It's a very safe city normally. It's one of the main downtown drags where people go shopping and go to restaurants, and it took a lot from the city. But I think what we've seen in the months since then is that the city is more resilient than I think anyone could have ever imagined. This year, more people are running the Boston Marathon than ever have of recent years, and people are running for charities. They're running for the One Fund. They're running for the individual victim charities. They're showing that we're not afraid, and Boston actually expects a record crowd on Monday the 21st when the 118th marathon is run, and it just shows that people are not going to stand down to terror incidences like this.
We hear this phrase a lot, Boston strong. Does that have any significance to you? What does that mean to you?
I think Boston strong kind of taps into the sense of community that has grown out of the events that happened last April. The city has really grown together. It has come to support all the victims, both in terms of running the marathon on their various foundation teams or donating millions of dollars to the One Fund through bake sales or what have you. So I think Boston Strong shows the resilience, but also the sense of community that this city has.
That was Catherine Cloutier, data producer with the Boston Globe. Words, words, words. In the beginning was the Word, according to the Gospel of John. Others say Greece is the Word, or Word is Bond. Words are the star centerpiece of LA's annual Festival of Books, a sprawling gathering for authors, audiences on USC's campus. The Festival of Books took place last weekend and drew a crowd of thousands. Arts and culture producer Graham Clark headed to the festival along with reporter Angie Fiedler Sutton. Here's the opening ceremony featuring a panel of writers from the LA Times.
Los Angeles Times Festival of Books at the University of Southern California.
Our theme this year is Inspire Your Fire, and we sincerely hope that the festival just does that, all in celebration of the written word.
My name is Patrick Brown. I'm director of author marketing for Goodreads. It's an exciting thing. It's great to be able to put readers and writers together in the same room and see what happens.
I can think about reading as a solitary adventure. You and the book in a room or outside. but what you're all talking about and what you're working on and spending your days doing is, you know, enlarging that experience so that reading is shared between people.
That was Chris Daly of Woodcraft LA. For more coverage of the LA Festival of Books, visit neontommy.com. Keep clicking on our website, annenbergradio.org, for more news about South Los Angeles, and remember to follow us on Twitter at Annenberg Radio. Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
Sonic City!
I'm here at the DMV in Culver City, and I just applied for my learner's permit, and I passed. It was easy. They tested me and took my thumbprint. That's it. An eye test, and I had to take a photo. I missed 4. It wasn't that hard. I didn't study too much. The kid behind me didn't pass.
Now surging F107 at window number 16.
Now we check in with Ben Capinos to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Hey, Ben.
Hey, well, friends and family continue to mourn the loss of victims from last week's bus crash. ATVN brings you to a candlelight vigil for 2 of the victims and reaction from the family. Also, people around Los Angeles remember today Jackie Robinson. Find out how his legacy is still being passed on. They actually were at Dodger Stadium today in the park nearby, and they actually had a clinic for the younger kids in memory of Jackie Robinson.
That's wonderful. LA Dodger Stadium's really turning around. I love it.
Yeah, it's great over there. It's great that they were able to celebrate the great heritage that they have with Jackie Robinson. Did a lot of great things for baseball.
All good things coming out of that stadium. Great. Thanks so much, Ben. I'm frozen. An Ohio State University study suggests that an eating candy bar can help keep spouses from fighting. Researchers found that subjects with lower blood sugar were more willing to push pins into a voodoo doll representing their significant other. So if you're going to be arguing sometime soon, you might want to bring some chocolate. That's it for this Tuesday. Production assistant is Lexi McAvinci. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment. And the newscast producer is Andy Vasoyan. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis. And for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ani Ukar.
Mm-hmm.